Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin, joined by Jack Spencer. A little later, Mark Grebner will be joining us. But first, Jack, the U.S. Senate wannabes on the Republican side had their first and only debate on Off the Record. It kind of reminded me why maybe candidates are afraid to go on Off the Record, but for a viewer, it was great viewing.
Well, yeah, you certainly can't say there wasn't a lot of action, because there was. And I would say that both candidates did the best they could to maximize their appearance, knowing that it was probably going to be the only time they really got to go together in front of the voters. I thought they both actually did a pretty darn good job, if you actually look at them. I think they probably did exactly what they had planned to try to do. James had to be the attacker more because he is, according to the polls, trailing. And Pensler did a pretty darn good job of defending.
He looked pretty senatorial. And while as James really tried to position himself as being the more conservative candidate, I thought he did a good job of doing that. Whereas I think Pensler looked more like the senator, the negotiator, the someone who's going to go in there and take care of Michigan first. And if a deal has to be cut, then a deal will be cut.
Well, yeah, I thought James did. You could almost see where what he had been told to go after. James, I think his attempt was to obviously to say, I'm more conservative. You know, my opponent isn't really the conservative he claims to be. But I think what James got out of it was clearly you did not walk away from watching that debate by having much doubt about James establishing his religious background, which is, of course, important in a Republican primary, and him, you know, establishing how strong he is as far as being pro-life. But, you know, just on that alone, you can say, man, he did everything he should do. But I thought Pensler, in every case, countered it. Mm-hmm. It was like Pensler was right on his game also. And I would say Pensler was like a defensive football team in the middle of the field, trying to prevent his opponent from getting farther down the field. And if James picked up anything, and remember, he's the one coming from behind, at best he may have gotten in a position for a field goal. I don't think he got close enough for a touchdown that he probably needed.
Sandy Pensler surprised me a little bit in this debate because he never got rattled. And I thought that in the end, if you're a centrist watching it, I thought he did fairly well. Now, in a conservative Republican primary, I don't know how that works.
I thought he did all right. He came across that way. I think the one shot at the voters, sort of a situation, I would argue that both of them accomplished what they wanted. I think James may have left not as much the things he did to attack Pensler, but the way he continually described himself, I think he may have created the image he wanted to create in the voters' minds for who he is, and that he's definitely conservative, etc. But Pensler got his licks in too, and certainly I don't think it was a knockout for either one at all. I think James did an excellent job. He gave every shot he could give, but Pensler certainly took them and then gave back a couple other ones on this person that, for instance, that James apparently donated to at one time that ended up being in favor of sanctuary cities. I thought it was I did not see a lot of mistakes.
You know, it's too bad this is going to be our only U.S. Senate debate. And on the flip side, it's unfortunate that we don't have more of these types of debates, no rules, back and forth exchanges on the gubernatorial side or really on any side. And is that just the way of the world now that candidates are so cautious about what they say and what type of venues they are in front of that the voters are kind of cheated out of any real exchange among the candidates?
Well, of course, the parties control the legislature and so on and so forth. And, if they wanted to set up some kind of, situation ahead of time, which I believe way, way back at a certain time, there were newspapers and there were media outlets that were attempting to set up required debates at the gubernatorial races, and there'd be no reason why they couldn't try the same thing, with senatorial races. But I just think the parties want to have their own, control over what does and doesn't happen. They don't want to have anything set up that compels candidates to participate in these things. So it ends up being a political decision. The leader probably doesn't want a debate. The person trailing probably does, but unless there's something in the polling or something that creates a reason that the candidates feel they have to do several debates. That's just not going to happen.
How unfortunate is that, though, to think about the person who's in the lead probably has more money, has more resources, can get his or her message out in various different ways, and doesn't need to go into basically what is a trial, if you think about it. If you kind of take it from the legal standpoint, what you try and do in a legal standpoint is you try and settle things and try and keep things in a controlled atmosphere, whereas you go to trial, it can be a bit of an uncontrolled atmosphere. And the same thing here with a debate. A debate can be a very uncontrolled atmosphere. Just take the last one here with Skubic. I don't think either of those candidates thought that they were going to be on the attack as much as they were. I think half that debate was attacking. And in hindsight, if they were to watch that video, I bet you they would have liked to had more of their message out there and more of their position on issues than going back and forth on who donated to whom.
I think James was, you know, he definitely had an agenda ahead of time to try to make up. When you're coming from behind, you pretty much have to stick to here are my points I'm going to hit, and here's what I'm going to go after. But yes, it is still interesting the extent to which even the moderator's questions control some different things and go various directions. So within that context of the moderator sort of setting where the sidelines are, et cetera, and changing direction by their questions, yeah, they end up attacking each other, and it ends up being a real quick view of how these two people are basically saying, this is what you did back when, this is what you did back when, et cetera. And I think, to your point, yeah, if I'm a voter that doesn't really know and hasn't been following what happens, and when I think of Sandy Pensler, I'm going, what is that? Is that the upper penciler or is that the lower penciler? You know, if I'm a voter who's at that level, I'm kind of hungry going, okay, I just saw the first chapter of this. I'd like to see some more. But unfortunately, you know, this is what they're going to get, and the rest is going to depend on what they see online, what they get in the mail.
Let's turn the page here on Christopher Graveling. He is an independent who was in the U.S. Attorney's Office, left his job as an assistant U.S. attorney, and is now running for Attorney General. Now, I mention this because he is now in the process of collecting signatures. He's got to collect 30,000 by, I think, late next week. The 19th is what sticks in my head here. Is there an avenue for an independent candidate to run in the Attorney General's race?
Well, I don't have a lot of faith in the third-party candidates being able to win. They can affect things. I'm interpreting what's happening as he's sort of representative of the Democrats who did not win at the convention. He's sort of taking that spot, saying that Nessel probably is too far left to win, and we need some way to get at this race, because every single race is so important this year. That's where he's going to try to make up for the fact that they've got a candidate they don't think can pull it off. I suspect it just all ends up playing to the advantage of the Republicans regardless.
Now, you could say, though, that if this Graveling has significant amount of resources, he could say that the Republican is too right, the Democrat is too left, and that if you want somebody who is not going to turn this office into a political theater, who is going to actually take up cases that deal more with the problems of the state, drug use, human trafficking, that type of stuff, then I'm your guy, because I have experience doing that kind of work as opposed to writing briefs on the political issue of the day or going after people for political reasons.
It's an uphill struggle, though. You know, I mean, what's everybody talking about in November? It's going to be turnout. It's going to be turnout. Which side turns out the most of their side? So in the middle of that, you have somebody coming along and saying, yeah, but on this one area, in this one place, you know, you're going to vote for an independent. I'm not saying it's impossible. Would you have enough money? You have clever enough ads? Maybe. But I just don't think third-party candidates stand much of a chance.
The other problem, too, is straight ticket voting. We still have it, but the courts could rule at any time that the law that eliminated straight ticket voting was legitimate, and it could be gone tomorrow for all we know. I mean, the federal courts are still looking at it. But assuming they don't, let's say this decision that has stayed that law is still in effect, you have straight ticket voting. That really, really hurts an independent.
Well, he'd certainly do better if there wasn't straight ticket voting.
Oh,
it
yeah.
allows people to go down there, because a lot of people who may see someone like this and say, well, gee, he's interesting, I may consider voting for him. A lot of by the time they've stood in line and they get in there and they vote, it's just, okay, the straight ticket's the easier way to go.
One last thing I want to touch on, voters not politicians. Supreme Court is looking at it right now. Decide whether it's going to go on the ballot or not. The two people in the hot seat here, Curtis Wilder and Beth Clement, and what are the Republicans going to do if they don't allow it on the ballot? If they don't, then clearly the Republican delegates would seem to give their blessing to have them on the ballot. They're on the ballot right now anyway because they're incumbents. But if they go ahead and allow it to go on the ballot, does that hurt Beth Clement and Curtis Wilder come election time as far as raising money from traditional Republican sources?
Possibly, but I don't know how much money they're actually going to need with the designation. I got to believe at the end of the day, they're going to end up deciding the case based on the merits. I know that sounds, you know, kind of Pollyannish, but I think at the end of the day, they look at what it looks like constitutionally, et cetera, and they say, you know, this is the way we're going to move. Now, in the back of your mind as to how you judge that, you know, who knows how the mental process works. But as far as up front in their own minds, I believe that consciously they're going to make a decision based on the law.
And let the politics go as the politics go. And
yeah.
If that means you don't get support from Republicans and traditional donors, that's just the way the ball bounces.
Yeah, I don't think you're going to allow something like that to affect you on this thing. I don't want to be too naive about the thing, but on something like this, I believe at the end of the day, you probably are better off just plain saying, here's how I interpret the case.
Well, with that, let's move on to Mark Grebner, who's walking into MERS World Headquarters right now. Joining me now in MERS World Headquarters is Mark Grebner. He's with Practical Political Consultants. Thanks for joining us, Mark.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's talk about absentee ballots, because it seems like more and more we're seeing folks using the absentee ballot system as a form of early voting, and we're seeing more of it. Give us an update about where we are right now on it.
In Michigan, more and more people are becoming absentee voters because you kind of fall into a routine. In general, the only people who can vote by absentee ballot without any particular reason are old people, people over the age of 60. If you're over the age of 60, the city clerk or township clerk where you live can, but isn't required to, send you an application automatically if you request one even once. Once you are sent an application and you get in the habit of mailing it back, and you receive a ballot and you vote it, then everybody assumes you're a regular absentee voter, and so they all bother you 2 months before the election. Once that starts happening, the average voter learns to receive an absentee ballot and vote it quickly, because then all the candidates stop coming by and calling. So there's this tremendous built-in incentive to vote absentee to get everybody off your back.
So absentee voting basically started a week or two ago, didn't it?
The ballots are supposed to be ready 45 days before the election, which would put it about June 23rd, give or take a couple days. There's always a lawsuit somewhere, and there's always a misspelled name on the ballot, and there's always some confusion. But in Detroit happened to be about the first place in the state to put out ballots. So they got their ballots out about the 22nd of June, and they've received back, as of today, about 20 or 22% of them. Mm. So they've got back, maybe 6,000 ballots in hand. The rest of the state, the numbers are more like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5%, because we're a few days further behind than that.
Mm. So talk about the increase in it. Can you put into percentages how much we're expecting from absentee ballots this year as opposed to years past?
You should understand that absentee voting is kind of independent of how interesting the election is. And so absentee voting doesn't ebb and flow the way the rest of the election turnout. In a high turnout primary, maybe we would have as many as 2 million votes. In a very boring primary with nothing much on the ballot except local issues, we might only have 1.2 million. But the absentee vote doesn't go up and down, because you request an absentee ballot not knowing what's on the ballot. So you just get the application. You send in the application. The city clerk sends you a ballot. And then you hate to throw a ballot away. I mean, it just seems wrong. Somebody's actually mailed you this ballot. and all these minor candidates, even if it's a boring election, you know, you go ahead and vote the ballot.
You don't have to pay for postage, right?
You do, actually.
Oh, you
they're
do
not,
have to pay
not
for
allowed,
postage.
They're okay. not allowed. Many cities paid for it before, and that's been determined to be illegal. So, yes, you're out 71 cents these days.
Okay.
But still, you hate to throw away a ballot. It just seems sort of, you know, like throwing away a $1 bill. You know, it just seems like there's something wrong with throwing a $1 bill in the trash. Nobody
so
can
people
do it.
Vote. So if they get an absentee ballot, they're going to vote. And so you can't determine whether this is going to be a high right. turnout election based on the absentee ballots.
Right. And so for the primary, almost all the absentee vote is this automatic, never-failing old people who are on the list, who get the ballots, who've done it a bunch of times. Okay. And there are a whole bunch of people over the age of 60 who don't use an absentee ballot. But once they start using an absentee ballot, they just get stuck in the system because now you get the ballot mailed to you. You know, you feel like that's how you're supposed to vote. So my guess is we'll have, maybe 550,000 absentee ballots in this election. That's just a wild guess. And maybe we'll have 1.7 million or 1.8 million total votes cast. So maybe that'll be, you know, 30 or 28% of the total vote.
If 28 to 30% of the vote. And let's say 10 years ago, absentee ballots made up how much of the vote?
Now, again, we're talking about an even-year primary. Of a typical even-year primary, let's go back away to 2002, which had a very large turnout because the governor's race, when Granholm was nominated. So that year, it was probably more like 22%. So of the 1.8 million votes, maybe 400,000 was absentee. So it creeps up just because more and more people kind of get, you know, it's kind of like paying your bills with auto pay, right? You sign up, nobody ever starts writing a check. Nobody ever gets a hold of the company and says, no, I don't want to have auto pay anymore. I'd like to mail you a check. Please mail me a bill every month. It's the same phenomenon that it only goes up. It doesn't go down as a method. So the rest of the vote goes up and down because the rest of the vote requires you on election day to decide you care enough about this election and these candidates to actually go vote. So that part varies, see? Mm-hmm. But so the absentee percentage goes up and down in inverse relation to the importance and interest of the vote. Because if the election is really interesting, the absentee vote doesn't go up very much. But the walk-in vote goes up a lot. Mm-hmm. If it's a really boring election, I've actually seen elections where 80% of the vote was absentee because there was nothing on the ballot worth voting on. And the only people who bothered to vote were absentee voters who just felt like they couldn't throw the ballot away. And if the only thing to do was mark yes, yes, and to vote for the two incumbent school board members, then that's what they did.
So if you're advising campaigns, is it changing now? Are campaigns having to change with this phenomenon? Say, you know, we really got to get mail out in June as opposed to, let's say, August. Or we have to get mail out in September as opposed to November to compensate, to reach these people who are going to vote and are going to be voting absentee.
As the process gets more organized, the political system is adapting to that. If you're putting out, let's say you have one piece of mail you're sending to every voter in your race, every likely Democratic primary voter, every likely judicial voter, whatever it is, you would automatically break that mailing into two pieces, one of which would go out timed with the absentee ballots, not necessarily the same day the ballots are mailed, but realizing that the absentee voters think of the election as happening 40 days or so before the election. And the other piece timed for the walk-in voters, okay? So we know increasingly who the absentee voters are. For one thing, because we have a track record for each voter, we know who has voted by absentee ballot in the past. But also, for most voters in the state now, there's data available on a daily basis from the Secretary of State. So it's possible for a campaign to specifically mail to the people who have today requested an absentee ballot.
You can get that service? Do you have to pay for it?
Of course.
Okay.
But it's not much money. And anybody who wants it can have it. It's just every day they send you 25 megabytes of data or 50 megabytes of data, and it's just full of names and addresses. And
so if you're a voter and you want to quit getting the mail, all you got to do is vote absentee, and a lot of these campaigns will just write you off.
That's right. Now, you may get a flurry as long as you've got the ballot and haven't returned it.
Oh, okay.
There may be a line at your door. but once you mail it back, that stops. In states which have gone entirely to mail-in vote, right, which now are three states, Washington, Oregon, and more or less Colorado, okay, but two of those states don't even have Election Day activity anymore. There's simply nothing that occurs on Election Day in Oregon or Washington. Mm-hmm. So they simply vote by absentee, by mail-in ballot. Mm-hmm. But everybody's mailed a ballot, whether you apply for one or not. Okay, in those states, there's a tremendously strong incentive to mail your ballot back right away, which is why they have such a strong turnout in those states. Mm-hmm. Because as long as you've got a ballot, the campaigns run, as they check names off their list, they devote all of their remaining resources to bothering you, right? and so to get off that list, you don't want to be the last person in this, unless you are lonely, I guess, but you don't want to be the last person who still has a ballot.
Yeah, right. Let's change subjects here, because I know that you're always very interested in polling on ballot proposals, and you're very specific about this. So first question I want our listeners to hear, your philosophy on polling ballot proposals.
You can poll ballot proposals if you want, and you could also buy a bunch of goats and slaughter them ritually and have their entrails read. And my guess is you probably would come out closer by reading goat entrails than you would by polling, and it'll cost less, and you'll have lunch, okay?
Now, why is that?
Well, it turns out, it's almost a miracle that candidate polling works, but it turns out, we should look at the question the other way. Candidate polling turns out to work because if you ask somebody over the phone, are you voting for Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton, you get more or less the same answers as that same person will do when they go vote. But if you call somebody up and ask them how they feel about
medical marijuana,
that
or,
may be
or legalized
too easy.
Legalized marijuana.
Well, let's take a tougher one. How do you feel about the Voter Bill of Rights? And then I read you the seven provisions about the Voter Bill of Rights. Well, you've never thought about it. You didn't know you were voting, but nonetheless, you answer the question, right? It turns out that the way you answer the question to a phone interview may differ from your vote at the polls by 40 percentage points. We've actually seen cases. The one I love best is in 2006. The realtors pushed through a constitutional amendment to restrict the use of eminent domain.
Oh, yeah, I remember that one, yeah.
So that polled at 43%, okay? It was 43% yes in the polls, including one by Ann Selzer, who is out of Iowa, one of the best pollsters in the United States, maybe the best pollster in the United States. Well, I did some polling, which is completely different, not using telephone interviewing, and I had the same interview or the same question at 87% yes. And the Free Press ran its poll Thursday before the election. I just love to tell this story. And Dawson Bell was the reporter who with the byline. And I got a hold of Dawson over the weekend before the election. So their poll is out 4 days before Election Day. And I said to him, so you say it's at 43, and I say it's at 86. And I'm right, and you're wrong. But the question is, your poll, which has a margin of error of 4 points, so plus or minus four, right? When you're off by 40 points on Election Day, will that be news? And Dawson wrote back to me and said, the position of the Free Press is that we will stick with our numbers through Election Day, and then we're going to pretend it didn't happen. He actually said that. I have this email. So it came in at 80%. We missed by 6 points, right?
It passed with 80% of the vote.
Yeah, but their poll, which was done very competently, very well, but it was a question involving whether the Constitution should be amended to restrict the use of eminent domain for distressed properties by municipalities when private blah, blah. And people were listening to this over the phone, and they guessed they'd vote no. And then when they actually saw the language, it turned out they voted yes. Well, the point is that the poll might even be considered to be right. Maybe the ballot was wrong. But the point is, you got a different answer when they read the ballot from what they said when they were asked over the phone. I mean, there are a lot of differences. There's a person reading it to you who clearly has something better to do than talk to you, so they're kind of impatient, and there you are hemming and hawing. the person who's called you knows who you are and you do not know who they are, so you don't want to sound dumb. You know, I mean, you're looking at it. Maybe you can read better than you can listen, or you can listen better than you can read. The point is, it's a different experience.
So how do you do it?
It's really dumb. We pick a whole bunch of random people in the state, and I have somebody drive there and ask them if they'd fill out a ballot. And we tell them it's anonymous, and here's an envelope with a stamp on it, and fill out this ballot, which has president and Supreme Court and Secretary of State and Attorney General and Congress and Court of Appeals, just all kinds of stuff to tire them out so they don't start with a ballot proposal, right? So the ballot proposal is on like page 5 of this long, tedious thing, which is like a typical
just
ballot.
Just like a regular ballot, yeah.
Yeah, except we can't really make it just like a regular ballot because I will never know who is running for township board in West Bloomfield,
right?
It's just too hard. But I have enough stuff that it's exhausting to vote, right? And then they mail it back, and we've never been off by more than 9 percentage points. Now, that isn't a great record for a poll, but we've been off by 9 a bunch of times. We've been off by less than that a bunch of times. Mm. But anyway, that's the method. So my solution to trying to make it a lot more like voting a ballot is to try to make it just like voting a ballot, especially like voting absentee.
Now, don't you pay them also to fill it out?
Yeah.
Pay them a buck or something?
Yeah, we give them a $1 coin.
Okay.
And we do that mainly because we want to make it such a strange experience that they don't forget to send us the ballot back. We want to make them feel guilty about having received our ballot and our coin, because if we spend so much money to have people drive to these 1,000 random addresses in the state that, you know, I really want to get as high a return rate as I can. So we get about 50 or 55% of them back.
That's pretty good. It's not random, though, right? I mean, you have a general idea of what type of person you're looking for, right?
They're randomly chosen. It's what's called clustered random sampling, so that we do 50 consecutive addresses on a couple of streets in a precinct, but we choose those randomly.
Oh.
But we exclude a handful of kinds of neighborhoods because they're just too hard for us. So a neighborhood that consists entirely of scattered farms, we don't do. A neighborhood anywhere in the Upper Peninsula, we don't do, because I'm willing to pay mileage, but I'm not willing to pay mileage to the Upper Peninsula. We don't do gated communities because we just can't figure it out. We don't do secure apartment buildings because I can't figure those out. And I have told all of our canvassers that if they ever go to a neighborhood where there is a lookout at the end of the block, they don't have to do that one either.
Wow, that's pretty interesting. Well, do you plan on doing that again this year?
Yeah, I'm really excited about it. There are 5 different ballot proposals on the ballot, right?
It looks like that's what it's going to be.
And they're all things that involve a lot of money. And we're hoping that there are people willing, on both sides maybe, of each question, who would like to have the information in advance of how they're doing and how they're doing in different parts of the state and among Democrats and Republicans and so forth. And we can provide all that information. We've done this a bunch of times. And so anyway, yes, if anybody's listening to this who'd like to subscribe, we will be opening subscriptions. We'll probably be starting mid-August. We can't really start until we have final ballot language from the Secretary of State. And I don't know exactly when they're going to adopt it, but it has to be no later than about August 15th because somebody's got to print the damn ballots.
So this is like tracking, right? Or do you just do it one time?
Well, you can't do it one time because you got 1,000 addresses to drive to. You know, so trust me, there's no doing it all at one. This isn't like, you know, robo dialing. You know, you poke the button and it happens. You got 3 people being paid mileage with maps and lists and driving around, and somebody's going to Clawson and then Warren and then Ferndale and then back, and somebody's doing Kalamazoo and then, you know, West Branch or something. You know. So anyway, we actually will probably do August, September, October, and it's kind of fun because as the stuff comes back, we actually type it into a Google spreadsheet, and some of our subscribers, I can tell, are actually watching online as my data entry person types, and so they're actually like watching the mail come in each day. It's very real time. Of course, we're about like 5 days behind because the mail takes a while to get here. But
Mark Grebner with Practical Political Consultants, thanks for coming in and doing the podcast here with us today.
Thank you for having me.
All right, that's going to do it for this week's edition of MERS Monday. Thanks to Mark Grebner for coming in. Jack Spencer, Jacob Cantor, I just found you roaming around. Where you been?
We're out on the, we did a pure Michigan road trip, Kyle. We did, my wife and I
Road tripped slash camped up the West Michigan coast. Did almost all the UP. It's a lot of driving.
How many miles you put on that car?
Yeah, I should have kept the odometer at the beginning, but I'm pretty sure I put a couple thousand miles on the new car.
Whoa. Couple thousand?
Yeah.
Wow. Did you spend more time in the car or out of the car?
I think more time in the car. But we had so many stops that I think the biggest chunk of driving was 4 hours. So after a while, 2 hour, 1 hour trips were nothing.
What did you listen to in the car besides the MERS Monday podcast?
Oh, we tried to find some radio station in the UP. There's not much up there.
Did you turn on the John Yob station?
You know, I don't know. I'm not sure. I can't tell which ones are
if
his.
If it was a conservative talk station, it was probably the John Yob station.
No, I didn't get to hear any of Yob's offerings. So
okay. Did you see any campaign signs?
Oh, we saw a lot. I don't remember the district off the top of my head, but that West Michigan district where Ray Franz is trying for the state senate, there are a lot of Ray Franz signs.
Is that right?
And Cali has a lot of signs around the bridge area, north of the bridge, just speckled throughout the UP.
Wow, if only trees could vote. Or the moose. He'd be doing great.
If only.
If only. And that's going to do it for this week's edition of the MERS Podcast. Thanks AT&T for sponsoring this and all our other podcasts. Until next week, I'm Kyle Hill. Take care.